Okay, so we'll start with the Araka Sutta. This is the 74 in this here. And this translation is done by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And this is in the upcoming Anguttara Nikaya. It's probably a sutta that you have never read before because it hasn't been published in any kind of modern translation. Here we go. Bhikkhus, in the past there was a teacher named Araka, the founder of a spiritual sect, one without lust for sensual pleasures. The teacher Araka had many hundreds of disciples. The teacher Araka taught the Dhamma to his disciples thus: Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. So here we have, this is in a time other than the Buddha. This is like a long time ago. This is like a story from the past which the Buddha is telling his disciples, telling the monks. And this Araka, he was a teacher. In other words, he was like a spiritual leader, the founder of a spiritual sect. It's like almost like a founder of a religion, if you like. And he was without lust for sensual pleasures. Now this, without lust for sensual pleasures, is basically a shorthand for somebody who attains deep samadhi, somebody who attains jhanas, basically. That's what this is shorthand for. Because only when you attain samadhi to the stage where you can actually get the jhanas, only at that stage are you without sensual pleasures. Before that, you will still have them to some extent. So he obviously was a profound meditator, this Araka. And because it is a long time in the past, of course, there was no Buddhism at this point. So this was about as far as you could go when there is no Buddhist dispensation available. And he had many hundreds of disciples. And he taught the Dhamma in this way. Brahmins here just means just an honorific. It just means like, honored students almost. It doesn't mean that they were all Brahmins necessarily. It's just the Buddha also sometimes uses that word. It just means that, they considered, highly considered. And Brahmin is like a word of honor for these students. That's why it says Brahmins, because they're all practicing properly. And then you have this beautiful little saying here: short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. And the point here is basically just to point out the impermanence of life, and that there is plenty, that there is enough suffering in any person's life. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome, lead the spiritual life. The spiritual life is like, here it means the celibate life, so it means like a monastic life, if you like, or certainly celibate anyway. For one who is born cannot escape death. So the point here is that he's saying that human life is fleeting and it is short, there is suffering, and you cannot escape death. In other words, he's pointing out that we're all going to die eventually. He's pointing out the impermanence of life. He's pointing out the suffering of life. And when you understand these things, the impermanence and suffering of life, that is when you understand that you should do what is wholesome and lead the celibate life, the spiritual life. In other words, it's a consequence of reflecting in this way. Once you reflect on death, then you also tend to be more spiritual in a sense. And we all know this is true. There's the same thing in Buddhism as well. It's a very big part of the Buddha's teachings is to reflect on death. Because somehow this reflection on death, it clears the mind of all kinds of obstacles and all kinds of hindrances. And it becomes clear that, practicing goodness, practicing kindness, practicing the Eightfold Path, practicing meditation or whatever, all these things, they become so important in the face of death. There seems to be like, this is one of the basic truths in a sense of life, that when you focus on death, you tend to move in this direction. And we've all heard of people who come close to death, and afterwards they often say that their life has changed. It's got much more spiritual direction to it, much more spiritual emphasis because of that. So this is an important reflection, not only for Araka and his followers, but also if one follows the Buddha's teachings, it's also obviously a very important reflection, this idea of death. So, and then we have a few similes here, and the similes are, the point of the similes is to point out how fleeting life actually is. But just as a dewdrop on the tip of a blade of grass will quickly vanish at sunrise and won't last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a dewdrop. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. Very strong, basically comparing the length of life to the time it takes for water to evaporate at sunrise from a blade of grass. It's very strong simile here. And I think this is one of the things in life. It's very hard to imagine that we're going to die. It's very difficult sometimes. But often it happens, and basically whenever it happens, people are generally speaking not ready to die when it actually happens, because we have this sense. We don't have this sense of urgency. We don't have this understanding that death can happen at any time, and it happens much sooner than normally we are prepared for. Just as when rain falls from the sky in thick drops, a water bubble will quickly vanish and won't last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a water bubble. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just like a line drawn on water with a stick will quickly vanish and won't last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a line drawn on water with a stick. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a river flowing down from a mountain, going a long distance with a swift current, carrying along much flotsam, won't stand still for a moment, an instant, a second, but will rush on, swirl, and flow forward, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a mountain stream. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. And this, I think this is a nice simile for what life can be like for maybe many people. It's like we just do things, do, and keep on going. I just went back and visited my family in Europe just recently. I just came back a couple of days ago. And certainly that's what happens there. They just do, one thing after the other. And suddenly, after just doing, suddenly that's, you come to the end and that's it. Life is over. It's just one long series. It's like a river rushing along, doing things, one thing after the other. Carrying along much flotsam. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but maybe it means that there is an amount of suffering, maybe, as you move along. Flotsam, maybe. It's maybe a simile for suffering here. I'm not sure. The next one here. Just as a strong man might form a lump of spittle at the tip of his tongue and spit it out without difficulty, so too, Brahmins, human life is like a lump of spittle. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as a piece of meat thrown into an iron pan, heated all day, will quickly vanish and won't last long, so too, Brahmins, human life is like this piece of meat. It is limited, for none who are born can escape death. Just as when a cow to be slaughtered is being led to the shambles, whichever leg she lifts, she will be close to death, close to slaughter, close to death. So too, Brahmins, human life is like a cow doomed to slaughter. It is limited and fleeting. It has much suffering and misery. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome, lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. And it's interesting here that the cow is led to the slaughter, and for every movement this cow does, she will be one moment closer to death, whatever she does. And human life is the same, so you can almost imagine yourself, for every act you do in this life, you are one moment closer to death for every act. Moving relentlessly towards death, so to speak. Yes? Yeah. Okay, yeah, right. Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. So everything which is not part of spiritual life, yeah, that makes sense to me. So, I think you can probably interpret that in several ways. So that certainly makes sense. Please ask questions at any time if you like. Please just raise your hand. I haven't been actually watching all that well. Those are some good similes there, I think, for the shortness of life and how quickly it passes. And it's one of the things that I always noticed is that when you meet somebody who is older and they know they've only got a short time left, they always say, oh, this whole thing just happened so quickly, it's hard to imagine, it's all over already. It just vanishes just like that, like a snap of a finger. And so these similes, I think they're quite apt. It may sound like an exaggeration, but I think in reality, this is actually what it feels like when it comes to the end of your life. It feels just like a bubble that just suddenly just get, you know, the bubble bursts and that's it. Life is over. That's what it often feels like, I think. That's what you hear. And the important thing, of course, is to try to get these things into one's head, because the more real this becomes, that life is short, that it ends very quickly, the more powerful will be one's resolve to practice goodness and kindness and do any kind of spiritual practice, really. It means that you're creating all the causes for yourself, for happiness in the future and for spiritual progress. We're moving on down here. But at that time, because the human lifespan was 60,000 years, and at 500 years, girls were marriageable. At that time, people had but 6 afflictions: cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. Though people had such long lifespans and lived so long, and though their afflictions were so few, still, the teacher Araka gave his disciples such a teaching: Brahmins, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much suffering, much misery. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. I find this really puts things into perspective, because this is what life was like in those days. You became 60,000 years old before you died. That was a lifespan. And yet still, it is like the water evaporating from a blade of glass. It still is very short. And even though they only have these very minor types of suffering, most people wouldn't consider these things suffering at all, but if you are aware of them, of course they are suffering if you focus on these things. But it is very, very minor, and yet they say life has much suffering, much misery. So this puts things a bit in perspective when you consider how we live today, these days. I find that quite a powerful statement there, actually. I always noticed that when I read that sutta for the first time. And I think the point is, even though you may live for 60,000 years, the funny thing is that when you actually eventually come to the end of life, it still feels like just a bubble bursting. It still feels very, very short. And it still feels like nothing really, it was just a finger snap, basically. And this is true for any kind of lifespan. If you, for example, if somebody gets reborn in the heavenly realm, and maybe they stay there for millions of years, sometimes people think, oh, I'll just make lots of good karma, I'll get reborn in the heavenly realm, I'll be nice and happy. But what they forget is that even though you get reborn in a heavenly realm, the day will come when there's an end to this heavenly realm. And when the end comes, then when you look back, it will feel just like this, just like a finger snap, just like a water bubble bursting. That's how short it will feel. So you can't really escape anything by getting reborn in the heavenly realm. It too will be fleeting. And then when it comes to an end, you will wonder, you know, what happens next? What was that all about? What is my destination from here on? So it puts it in a nice perspective. And then the Buddha continues, but nowadays, bhikkhus, one could rightly say, short is the life of human beings, limited and fleeting. It has much misery, much suffering. This one should wisely understand. One should do what is wholesome and lead the spiritual life, for none who are born can escape death. For today, one who lives long lives for 100 years, or a little more. And when living for 100 years, one lives just 300 seasons, 100 winters, 100 summers, and 100 rains. When living, 3 seasons here, these are the seasons of They had in India, at the time of the Buddha, they had three seasons of the year, winter, summer, and the rainy season. These were the three seasons that the Indian year was divided into. When living for 300 seasons, one lives for just 1,200 months. 400 winter months, 400 summer months, and 400 months of the rains. When living 1,200 months, one lives just 2,400 fortnights. 800 fortnights of winter, 800 fortnights of summer, and 800 fortnights of the rains. A fortnight is a very important unit in the suttas, because they follow the lunar calendar. So the fortnight is like the half moon. So you have the moon from being new, it diminishes until you get to the half moon, and that's one fortnight, and then it continues to diminish until you get the new moon, and that is another fortnight. So because it was a lunar calendar, the fortnights were very important in those days. That's why they're mentioned here. And when living for 2,400 fortnights, one lives just for 36,000 days, 12,000 days of winter, 12,000 days of summer, and 12,000 days of the rains. And when living for 36,000 days, one eats just 72,000 meals, 24,000 meals in winter, 24,000 in summer, and 24,000 in the rains. And this includes the taking of mother's milk and the times when there are obstacles to meals. Therein, these are the obstacles to meals. One is disturbed. One who is disturbed does not eat a meal. One who is grieving does not eat a meal. One who is ill does not eat a meal. One observing the Upasita does not eat a meal. And when not obtaining anything to eat, one does not eat a meal. The point here is just to say that 72,000 meals also includes all the times when one should have had a meal, but one wasn't able to get one. Thus, because for a human being with a lifespan of 100 years, I have reckoned his lifespan, the limit of his lifespan, the number of seasons, years, months, and fortnights, the number of his days, meals, and obstacles to meals. Whatever bhikkhus should be done by a compassionate teacher out of compassion for his disciples, seeking their welfare, that I have done for you. There are these feet of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not be heedless. Do not have cause to regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So this is the last passage here. This is a standard passage you see in quite a few suttas, where the Buddha says to the monks, get on with the practice, basically. The job of the Buddha is just to teach the Dhamma, to give a sense of urgency in the monks, to teach them about impermanent suffering and non-self, etc. And once he has established that sense of urgency in people, then it's up to the monks to do the practice. So this is what's happening here. So he says here then, after he has, I have done what a compassionate teacher does for his disciples, and he says, there are these feet of trees, these empty huts. And of course, this is like in the forest. This is places which are secluded, away from empty people. That's why he's talking about the feet of trees and empty huts, because of that's where one should ideally meditate, in a secluded place, because that's when you can get the deepest sort of meditation. Meditate, because do not be heedless. Meditate is jayati. It is directly related to jhana, the word jhana. So jhana and jayati are the same type of word. So when you say jayati, meditate, it means attain jhana, practice jhana. That's what it means. It may not mean exclusively that, but that is the main import of this word, to practice jhana. Do not be heedless. Do not, in other words, don't waste time, don't mess around. Just get on with the fact. Do not have cause to regret it later. And of course, this is the problem with life, is that if you have a chance to do the spiritual practice, you don't take the opportunity. Then when life comes to an end, you look back, you think, oh, I had the opportunity, I didn't take the chance. And you might feel a sense of remorse on your deathbed. And of course, that is something you try to avoid. This is our instruction to you. Any questions on that sutta? Yes, you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
How did I get here? How have I done? And it's like, none of that really matters.
Right. Yeah.
It only matters now. So this is sort of timing thing, not to do with how many years. It's, are you in the present? Or were you in the present in the past or not? Or was it you just doing your life? These are just some ideas that I was thinking about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I'm now here, but it's like the past is not relevant anymore.
Yeah.
And therefore, this is irrelevant and what I'm doing now. And therefore, the time is, doesn't matter whether it's 50 years or 100 years.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be any time at all. But, you know, it's, I can't quite explain it. I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. 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 Yeah, sure.
Of how long a life is.
Right, right.
And yeah. Really, the life is only about when you've woken up.
Mm.
And the good thing is, it's only about waking up. Because we generally get bored, and then we fall asleep until we wake up. You see, and then we die. That's the normal thing.
Yeah.
We fall asleep in the way that we don't know what we're doing.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Or we're not practicing what the Buddha's teaching or a spiritual life that we're just getting caught up in the world all the time. And therefore we don't know what's going on.
Mm.
So we wake up and realize that there is something going on.
Yeah. Sure, exactly, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly. And that waking up, I mean, that is basically like being heedless. If you, that time period when you're sort of asleep, you're basically being heedless because you're not following the teachings properly. So there's a period of heedlessness. But that is fair enough, you know, that fact that you are heedless until you come across the teachings is to be expected because you don't know any better. So, of course, that's fine. You never get remorse for that because you couldn't do any better. That was basically where you were at anyway. That's all you could do. But the time you get remorse is actually if you know better, you understand the teaching, you know what has to be done, but you sort of couldn't get bothered to do it. That's when you get a sense of remorse, I think. And that is when you look back and you see that if your life hasn't been well spent and you look back, you think, ooh, I should have done better, and you feel bad about it. If you have spent your time well in the past, then the past becomes irrelevant because then you have done what is right, you feel good about yourself, you feel that you have done what is to the best of your potential, and you feel okay. So that is, I think, yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sure. I think we're using it a bit loosely here. Huh? Yeah, yeah. 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 Most likely, yeah. It's hard to say. Most likely, it's just like it's just an example. Maybe it's very hard to say. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, it's very, very difficult to know whether any of these things are actually factual or not, but it doesn't really matter because I think the Dhamma is very clear, you know, the message is very clear. Whether it's factual or not is not really so important, I think. Yeah. Okay, so everybody happy? Yeah. So that was the first sutta. Because it was very short, I thought we'd do another one as well. And this is another one which I remember when I read it, I thought it was interesting. On the surface, it's quite simple, but it makes a few interesting points, which I thought was gave me some added understanding of the Dhamma. So this sutta is called Honor and Respect, and it goes as follows. Then, when the Venerable Sariputta was alone in seclusion, he thought thus, What should a bhikkhu honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on her, so that he might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome? Then it occurred to the Venerable Sariputta, a bhikkhu should honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on the teacher, so that he might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. He should honor, respect, and dwell in independence on the Dhamma, the Sangha, the training, concentration, heedfulness, hospitality, so that he might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. Okay, so here we have Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand monk, who was the wisest of all his disciples. And he says here, well, what is it that we should honor in this world? What is worthy in honor so that we might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome? In other words, making progress on the path. This is what making progress on the path is all about, abandoning the negative states and developing the wholesome states. What is it that we should respect and honor so that we may actually move forward in our practice? And then it occurs to him that there's these seven things that one should honor and dwell in dependence on her. And this is the teacher. The teacher is the Buddha, of course. And then you have the Dhamma, the Sangha. The Sangha here means the Arya Sangha, the noble ones, those who have seen the Dhamma for themselves. The training that leads to becoming an Arya, a noble one. Concentration, this is Samadhi. Samadhi, the most important part of Samadhi are the jhanas. These are the ones you would see again and again in the suttas. Heedfulness, in other words, being alert, being awake, being careful in how you act and what you do. The last one here is a bit funny, hospitality. It doesn't seem to really fit in very well. I think maybe a better translation here is something like cordiality or courtesy. In other words, that you treat other people generally well, with a sense of generosity and a sense of virtue and morality and kindness. That is what I would understand the last one as, instead of just hospitality. So these are the seven factors that one should honor and respect. And when you honor and respect these seven things, then and dwell in dependence on them, then you might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. I'll explain these things a little bit more later on when I come to a bit further down here. Then it occurred to the Venerable Sariputta, these qualities have been purified and cleansed in me. Let me go to the Blessed One and report these qualities to him. Thus these qualities will still be purified in me, but also known more widely as such. Suppose a man would find a gold nugget purified and cleansed. It might occur to him, this golden nugget of mine is purified and cleansed. Let me go and show this golden nugget to the goldsmith. Thus, when this golden nugget of mine has been to the goldsmiths, it will be just as purified, but also known more widely as such. So too, these qualities have been purified and cleansed in me. Let me go to the Blessed One and report these qualities to him. Thus, these qualities will be just as purified in me, but also known more widely as such. Okay, so the Venerable Sariputta is saying that these qualities have been purified and cleansed in me. Essentially, to understand, this basically just means, as far as I can understand, that he does have that honor, he does have that respect, and he does dwell in dependence on these seven things. And he does so to the highest degree. That's what he means by that they have been purified and cleansed. He doesn't have any defilements anymore because he's fully enlightened. Because he doesn't have any defilements, there's nothing to stop him from honoring and respecting and dwelling in dependence on these things. That's what he means here by purified and cleansed. And then he has this, he said things to himself that he should go to the Buddha to report this. Because a gold nugget will be more purified and cleansed, so to speak, if he gets well known, so too his own qualities will also, that would be some additional thing that is attained by reporting this. And I think the point here is that if you know it yourself that they are purified and cleansed, that's one thing. But of course, if you have this confirmed by a goldsmith, in this case confirmed by the Buddha, of course, then you have a confirmation that this is the case, and it becomes much more powerful when it is confirmed by a goldsmith and by the Buddha that this is the case, because then it is like a seal of approval, that this is, has actually been attained by Venerable Sariputta. Just like the goldsmith gives a seal of approval that the gold is pure, in the same way the Buddha gives a seal of approval that Venerable Sariputta is an arahant and has purified all these things. So then, in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion and went to the Blessed One. Having gone, he paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said, "Here, Bhante, when I was alone in seclusion, I thought thus." And then he relates everything that he has just thought before, and ends off, finishes up with, "Thus these qualities will be just as purified in me, but also known more widely as such." And the Buddha replies, "Good, good, Sariputta, a bhikkhu should honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on the teacher, so that he might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. He should honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on the Dhamma, the Sangha, the training, concentration, heedfulness, and hospitality, so that he might abandon the unwholesome and develop the wholesome." So the Buddha just repeating what the Venerable Sariputta says there. This is something you find quite often in the suttas. You find that one of the disciples will say something, and then after having said it to the Buddha will repeat it. In a sense, he's just putting his authority and his stamp of approval on that thing said by the disciple by repeating it. It means that it is a worthwhile statement made by that person, a perfectly correct statement. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta said to the Blessed One, "Bhante, I understand in detail thus the meaning of this statement that the Blessed One has spoken in brief." So this is another standard thing you see in the suttas, is that sometimes you see a summary of a teaching, and after the summary of the teaching has been given, then you get like a detailed exposition of that summary. So this then now is a detailed exposition of what above was just a summary here. "It is impossible, Bhante, that the bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher could have reverence for the Dhamma. A bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher also lacks reverence for the Dhamma." That is an interesting point, I feel. You see here that essentially, if you don't have any reverence for the Buddha, it is impossible that you can have reverence for the Dhamma. Why is that? And the reason is because the Dhamma is a type of teaching which has to be realized. You have to realize the Dhamma. Somebody has to actually experience it, have insight into it. And without that insight, there can be no Dhamma. And of course, the person who has the insight into the Dhamma is the Buddha. He's the first one. He's the one who starts this whole thing off. If it wasn't for the Buddha, there wouldn't be any Dhamma. There has to be this first person, first of all, who understands all of this, who has insight. So the Dhamma is a type of teaching which can only exist if there is somebody in the world who realizes it in the first place. So that is why it is impossible to have not to have a reverence for the teacher, for the Buddha, and then but still have reverence for the Dhamma. That is impossible. That cannot actually happen. And you will find that, for example, in the Noble Eightfold Path, in the first factor of right view, you find that one of the very first things of right view on the Noble Eightfold Path is to have faith that there are people in the world who have seen and have understood things that we haven't seen for ourselves. In other words, that there are spiritual practitioners who have understood something deep and profound that we haven't seen. This is the first aspect. Unless you believe that there is a Buddha, somebody who has understood something deep, then you don't even get started on this path. You have to have that faith, has to be there first of all. So that is basically saying the same thing here. So without believing and without having some faith in the Buddha, you cannot have faith in the Dhamma. So these two things, like, they go together. They are part and parcel of the same thing here. The next one: "It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher and the Dhamma could have reverence for the Sangha. The bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher and the Dhamma also lacks reverence for the Sangha." Now, This is why here we're talking about the Arya Sangha, the noble Sangha, those who have understood the Dhamma, understood the teachings. And of course, if you don't have any understanding, if you don't have any reverence for the teaching, if you don't accept the Dhamma as it is, then there is no path for attaining Aryahood, for becoming a stream enter, for becoming an Arahant. So if you don't believe in the path, if you don't believe in the teaching, then you can also have no idea of the Arya Sangha, the noble people who have realized this. It is only when there is a Dhamma in the world, when this teaching exists, that it is possible to have a Sangha, disciples who understand that teachings. These things again go together. You cannot have one without the other. And that is why, of course, that if you want to really learn about Buddhism, you have to understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, because that is like the ultimate final arbiter which decides what is the real teaching and what is not. So if somebody says something, it should always be checked against the suttas. Of course, sometimes it's difficult, because sometimes you don't have enough understanding of the suttas, you may be unsure how something should be interpreted, etc., etc. But ideally, that's the way to go, to interpret things, to decide on whether somebody has understood something, should be done by checking it against the suttas, against the Dhamma you find in the Pali Canon primarily, but also other places, Chinese discourses, etc. So then, Venerable Sariputta goes on, it is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, could have reverence for the training. A bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, also lacks reverence for the training. Of course, again here, the training, this is the path, it's like the Noble Eightfold Path and the gradual teaching, gradual training, all these things, all these practices you read about in the suttas that bring you towards enlightenment, starting from the time you hear about Buddhism until you attain the final awakening and you become an Arahant. And again, if you have a reverence for the teacher and the Dhamma and the Sangha, of course you also have reverence for the training, because you understand that the Dhamma is a training which leads to enlightenment. If you don't have any reverence for the Dhamma, the teacher and the Sangha, well, of course, then the training is really an aspect of that understanding, that enlightenment of the Buddha. So without enlightenment of the Buddha, again, there can be no reverence for the training as such. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha and the training could have reverence for concentration. The bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha and the training also lacks reverence for concentration. This is samadhi. It is interesting here that samadhi is mentioned in this way, and so early on, straight after the training. I think this shows the importance of samadhi in the Buddhist practice, that it comes like this. And again, when the suttas talk about samadhi without any further specification what actually is meant, you can take it as given that the most important aspect of that samadhi is the jhana practice. This is the most important type of samadhi in the suttas, the jhanas. So if you have a reverence for these things, it also means that you have reverence for samadhi, for the jhanas. This is part and parcel of having this faith in these in all of these things. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training and concentration, could have reverence for heedfulness. The bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training and concentration, also lacks reverence for heedfulness. So again, heedfulness is this ability to be aware and to be present and to know that you're doing the right thing, to be careful about doing what is right and what works on the path, and be careful avoiding what doesn't work. That's what heedfulness essentially is. You are careful about things. And of course, again, that heedfulness comes as a function of understanding the training, understanding the Dhamma, that this all leads in the right direction. If you don't have any faith in all these things, then heedfulness doesn't make so much sense anymore. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, the Sangha, the training, concentration, and heedfulness should have reverence for courtesy. Yeah? A bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, the Sangha, the training, concentration, and heedfulness also lack reverence for courtesy. In other words, you understand the importance of being kind, of being gentle, of being good, being compassionate, and all these things. This is part of the part and parcel here of the of having reverence for all these things. And you will note here the interesting thing, or one small point, is that there's three things listed here. There's concentration, there's heedfulness, and then there is courtesy or hospitality. And why are these three things listed? And I think that one way of looking at these three things is to look at them as a shorthand for the Noble Eightfold Path. You have concentration there, which is samadhi. So that, of course, is maybe the highest part of the Noble Eightfold Path. That includes samadhi and also maybe includes part of the satipatthanas. And then you have heedfulness. Well, heedfulness, I think, is closely related to right effort, because right effort means being careful to do what is good and avoid doing what is bad. So heedfulness is very close related to right effort. And hospitality or cordiality or courtesy, well, that is about morality. It's about being kind, being a good person. So this is the moral aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. Maybe starting with right intention all the way up to right livelihood. All these parts here are part of this factor. So you can see here how all the three factors, how these three factors essentially relate to the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view should then be understood, I would think, as the previous factors, as having faith in the teacher, and particularly the teacher and the Dhamma. This is the right view, which is already established there. That's at least one way of looking at it. I'm sure there's other ways as well. So once you have faith in the training, then of course you will have faith in all these aspects of the training, concentration, heedfulness, and courtesy. So then, Venerable Sariputta, having said this, now he turns it around, and he speaks of the same thing in like the reverse way, the opposite way. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher could lack reverence for the Dhamma. A bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher also has reverence for the Dhamma. In other words, if you know who the Buddha is, if you know who the teacher is, then it follows that you will have also know what the Dhamma is. The Dhamma, the one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha, the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. These things go together, they're not separate things. So once you understand, once you revere the teacher for his insight, for his understanding, then you also revere the Dhamma. Now the important point here is that what do we mean by reverence here? Because it's not very clear what that might mean. And of course, it can mean any form of reverence, but in particular, it means the type of reverence you have when you become a stream enterer. Because when you become a stream enterer, that is when you actually see the Dhamma for yourself. And that's when you understand for the first time with absolute certainty that the Buddha must have been enlightened. You see that because you know that a teacher like the Buddha, he could only teach the Dhamma in such a way if he had seen it for himself. And that's how you know that when you see the Dhamma, you know the Buddha must have been enlightened, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to teach the Dhamma in such a way. So that, I think, is ultimately what is meant here by reverence, is the type of faith and understanding you have as a stream enterer. So, if you are a stream enterer, you understand that the Buddha has reached awakening, that he is enlightened, that he has seen all these things, then of course it follows, as a matter of course, that you also have faith in the Dhamma, because this is just the expression, the verbal expression, of that enlightenment experience of the Buddha. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher and the Dhamma could lack reverence for the Sangha. A bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher and the Dhamma also has reverence for the Sangha. Because you understand that the teacher and the Dhamma, you understand that this teaching leads to enlightenment, then of course you also have reverence for those people who have attained that enlightenment. Even if only, maybe not fully, still the Arya Sangha are those people who have seen the Dhamma in the same way. You understand that this is a possibility because you have seen the Dhamma for yourself if you're a stream enter. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, and the Sangha could lack reverence for the training here. A bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, and the Sangha also has reverence for the training here. Because you understand the Dhamma, you know that this training works, you know that it leads to the results of people becoming enlightened, then of course you have reverence for that training here. This again follows from the previous one here. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and the training could lack reverence for concentration. A bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and the training also has reverence for concentration, for samadhi. Here the point is that if you have made a penetration to the true Dhamma, then you will by nature have reverence for samadhi, which of course includes the jhanas. So anybody who is an Arya will automatically have reverence for the jhanas and for samadhi more generally. So again, this points to the important aspect, how important this concentration and samadhi is in the practice of this particular path. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training and concentration, could lack reverence for heedfulness. A bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and the training and concentration also has reverence for heedfulness. And this word heedfulness, appamada, you find that in the suttas a lot. This is often said to be the foundation stone for the entire practice of the path. If you haven't got heedfulness, you cannot practice the path at all. This is like you find verses about this in the Dhammapada, you find verses about heedfulness in the early suttas of the Anguttara Nikaya. It's like the foundation stone. If you haven't got that, again, you can't go anywhere. Once you have seen the Dhamma, once you have seen these things for yourself, in other words, you have reverence for these things, then you understand the importance of being heedful. And for that reason, somebody who is an Arya can never actually do things which will lead to a lower rebirth in the future, because that heedfulness of the noble ones has been so firmly established that it is impossible for them to do things that will lead to a lower rebirth in the future. It is impossible, Bhante, that a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training, concentration and heedfulness, could lack reverence for hospitality or courtesy. The bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training, concentration and heedfulness, also has reverence for courtesy. You understand the importance of kindness and morality as the foundation for the path, and for this reason you have that reverence for these qualities. It is in this way, Bhante, that I understand in detail the meaning of this statement that the Blessed One has spoken in brief. Okay, so that is essentially the sutta. Now it is just a summarizing at the very end here, and the Buddha says, "Good, good, Sariputta, it is good that you understand thus in detail the meaning of this statement that I have spoken in brief. Indeed, Sariputta, it is impossible that a bhikkhu who lacks reverence for the teacher could have reverence for the Dhamma." And then he repeats the whole thing. "But a bhikkhu who has reverence for the teacher, the Dhamma and the Sangha, the training, concentration and heedfulness, also has reverence for hospitality or courtesy. It is in this way, Sariputta, that the meaning of this statement that I spoke in brief should be seen in detail." So, does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, Jacob. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It literally, the Pali word is patisantara. It means something like spreading out the rug. So it's like welcoming people, you know. So it is not very clear exactly, you know, how far it extends. But definitely, liberality, generosity, hospitality. And I would say even broader, I would say it even includes also, you know, kindness and goodness and virtue and all these things. But yeah, but I think the root meaning, you're probably right, actually is generosity as a root meaning here. Yeah. Well, pamada, the word pamada is derived from mada. Mada comes from intoxication. You intoxicated it. So yeah, pamada basically means that you intoxicated. It's just like, you know, intoxicated with sensual. This doesn't just mean intoxicated with alcohol. It means any kind of intoxication with sensual pleasures or whatever. That which makes you unable to see the Dhamma clearly, essentially, which confuses the mind, makes the mind. Yeah, you can say that, yeah. In a very broad sense. Intoxicated in a very broad sense. You could say that, yeah. Yeah. Having clarity. Yes.
So, in this context, sangha, does that understand as Viharya sangha?
Yeah.
Does it include the lay Arya, or does it exclude that?
I think essentially it includes the lay Aryans as well, I would say, because they have just as much, you know, seen the Dhamma as a monastic. It doesn't really make any difference. But I think usually usually when you talk about the Sangha in the sense of paying homage to the Sangha, usually that refers to the monastic Sangha, because they are like the symbol of that attainment, you know, because that's where you find these attainments, and usually that's where you have the highest kind of practice. And with lay people, it is more difficult to discern, you know, it is more, you can't really divide up so much. But of course, essentially, if you know that the layperson is an Arya, is just as much to be respected as a monastic who is an Arya. Yeah. Generally speaking, yeah. Except that as a monk, you still have given up more. I mean, you can still have a family life as a lay person, even though you're an Arya and all these things. So, yeah. I would say yes, you probably can, yeah, still can. It says in the sutras that almost any Arya, I think the exception is the Arahant, he cannot break any precepts. He can still break minor rules in the Patimokkha, though. Some of the rules in the Patimokkha were actually broken by Arahants, because you have to remember some of the Patimokkha rules are conventional rules and not haven't got anything to do with morality as such. So because they are just conventions, even Arahants can break them. But the five precepts, yes, you can break them. The only difference between a stream enter and an ordinary person is that a stream enter will confess that thing straight away. And that is how the Buddha explained this. That's actually from the suttas. So a stream enter will say, I did this, I confess, I will restrain myself in the future. But you can break these things. That's the basic distinction. Can't hide it, precisely. That's basically quite right. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, right? There's one sutta, it's also in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha talks about by judging people, how careful you have to be about judging people. Because he says that there are people who are Aryas, who may appear not to be Aryas. They may get angry, they may have all kinds of defilements, you know. But actually, they have penetrated the Dhamma despite those defilements. And again, that shows that, you know, of course, if you can get angry, it's also possible too often to break precepts, to do something rash in that state of anger. But it also shows very interesting that we have to be very careful with judging people around us, because sometimes people who may seem, you know, on the surface to have defilements can actually be very wise. So it's not clear cut that just because somebody is very kind and very nice, that does not necessarily mean that they are an Arya. And it's by the same token, that they... just because they're angry does not necessarily mean that they're not an Arya. These things are much more subtle than that. But of course, and that is why it is much more easy to judge the high Arya, somebody who is an Arahant or an Anagami, because at that point you cannot have any anger anymore. You cannot have any sensual desires. So that is much more easy to spot. But the areas at the stage of stream entry can be very hard to actually determine whether somebody is at that stage, because they can have defilements just like everybody else. Or they will have to some extent, of course. Yeah. So one should be very careful to judging people, because you end up, you know, creating a lot of bad karma for yourself and by saying things which are rash and saying things which are stupid. Of course, we should be critical. We should have critical faculties, of course, very important. But at the same time, we shouldn't make judgments too fast and be careful with our judgments. Yeah. Yeah. I think you can still perfect samadhi, I think. But I think the point here is that it doesn't say that. Let's say somebody has never met the Buddha before. Huh? Now that person doesn't necessarily disrespect the Buddha. It may just be because he didn't meet the Buddha, he doesn't have a chance to respect the Buddha. Huh? You see the difference? If he did meet the Buddha, or she did meet the Buddha, they might respect him. So the point is just that, you know, if, for example, if you live in a time when there is no Buddhism, or you live in a country where Buddhism is not strong, or you've grown up in a Christian culture or whatever, you may still have respect for the Buddha, or you may not know about him, but you would have had that respect there. So you can still attain these things because of that. So it's only really if you don't have that respect that it becomes impossible. In a sense, an implicit veneration, you can say, yes. An implicit understanding that this is good, this is good qualities, that there's something beautiful here. Yeah. So, because this sutta, the previous one, is a classical example of just that. The previous sutta is an example of a time when there was no Buddhism, and yet this Araka, he obviously attained samadhi, attained the jhanas. Yeah, there was no Buddha around. Yeah, that is another interesting point, because there are a number of suttas which talk about the human lifespan being very, very long. And I don't know whether this is just mythology or whether it is, you know, whether it actually is to be taken literally or what. I'm not sure. But perhaps it is to be taken literally. Perhaps there is such a thing. And I would then argue with, if the point is that, you know, human, according to this kind of thing, human life goes in cycles. From the lowest being 10 years up to maybe 80,000 years, goes in cycles. And I would, maybe what you would have to argue is that the human body is not the same when you live for 60,000 years. It's not this kind of physical body couldn't last for 60,000 years. So probably you have a more refined kind of physical body at that time. No, it's more like what you would call the human realm. But because the human realm goes through cycles, it can be... Human beings can take very different shapes. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. It would be a different type of earth anyway. Probably a different type of . Yeah. Right. But there may have been human beings, maybe. In a slightly parallel dimension, you know? I don't know. It's, this is one of those... Yeah. Sure, exactly. Because it is presented as if the Buddha is saying this, so it certainly looks like it, yeah. But, yeah. And this is... I must admit, there's some things in the suttas which I find, you know, difficult, and I And I think that sometimes you just have to shrug your shoulders and say, I don't really know. These are uncertain things. And there are things like the 32 marks of a great man you find in the suttas. And I find that very difficult to square with other descriptions of the Buddha in the suttas. It's very hard to understand how he could have these 32 marks. It doesn't make any sense. And I think that might be one of those things which have been come into the suttas at the later stage after the Buddha. Maybe as because Buddhism was challenged by the Brahmins or something. So maybe they had to bring these things in. But that is just one example. But there are a few things like that which seem strange and doesn't really seem to make any sense. So in those cases, I just say, don't know, not sure. Right. For example, where somebody is, exactly, doesn't recognize the Buddha, precisely. Precisely. Right. Yep. And also here, another place, he would exchange robe with somebody else, and without any problems. And other examples as well of nobody not recognizing the Buddha straight away. So, yeah.